Okay, this time, for real, it actually is Infrastructure Week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, August 2nd. Good to have you along. I know, you've heard this before, but this time there really is an infrastructure bill, an actual piece of legislation about 2,700 pages long, and it's got about $1 trillion of spending. Funding things like road and bridge repair, broadband expansion, and investments in mass transit. Of course, the existence of the bill, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, is very different than the passage of said bill. And to get there, you're probably going to hear a lot about the jobs part of this thing. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
On a typical construction site, you need workers to actually build and repair bridges and roads. But that's not all. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. He estimates the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act would create 650,000 jobs, paying about $70,000 a year on average, some of them in manufacturing.
Just take a look at a construction site. Those are the kinds of things, the manufactured things that will be needed for these projects. And, of course, it takes all kinds of people to produce those types of manufactured goods.
Sandy says these infrastructure projects could boost the economy in rural areas where it can be hard to find work. Tony Carnevale heads the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He estimates the Senate infrastructure bill would create about 1 million jobs, with 70% of them filled by people who didn't go to college.
People who have been pretty much left behind in the United States for 40 years now.
Even so, there aren't enough construction workers right now. Carnevale says the U.S. will have to issue more visas for temporary foreign workers if the infrastructure bill passes. Henrietta Trays at Veda Partners says Democrats will push for money to train U.S. workers for infrastructure jobs. And she thinks it'll be hard for members of Congress to vote against the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act.
You have to focus on things that can get substantial bipartisan support. And infrastructure and job creation is like vanilla ice cream. Everybody loves it.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he hopes the Senate will pass the bill in days. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Staying on the topics of jobs for a moment, more and more employers are making COVID vaccinations a requirement for people to keep their jobs. Federal workers will have to get vaccinated or get weekly COVID tests. Similar vaccine mandates are rolling out in California and New York. Add to that a long list of universities, hospitals, and increasingly private corporations requiring their workers to get the jab. One of the most recent, Walmart. But there's a catch. It's going to require vaccines for corporate employees, but not its retail workers. Marketplace's Christian Schwab has more.
Most employers have been doing what they can to encourage workers to get vaccinated. Now, virus variants are helping make their case.
I think that Delta has really been a game changer.
Lauren Rivera is a professor of management at Northwestern University. She says the pressure is building as companies move toward return-to-office target dates. Walmart's is Labor Day, and its office workers must be vaccinated by early October. But the company isn't requiring this for most of its employees, staff at stores and warehouses.
My best guess is that they are afraid of losing workers.
There's a big labor problem happening in retail right now. And Gretchen Chapman, who researches vaccine behavior at Carnegie Mellon, says a mandate could feel intrusive to frontline workers. Many of them have been on the job since last March.
It might be seen as insensitive to institute a requirement where the greatest burden of that requirement falls on the very people who have paid the biggest cost so far in the pandemic.
Chapman says Walmart might be hoping the corporate policy will have a trickle-down effect.
They can sort of signal like, hey, we really want to keep our workers and our customers safe and do our part nationally. And so we're starting at the top.
As one of the country's largest private employers, Walmart has influence, not just on its more than 1.5 million associates in the U.S., but on the service industry at large.
I'm certain there are a lot of other retailers paying attention to what they're doing and vice versa.
Vince DiGirolamo is with Mintel. For now, he thinks companies will keep taking baby steps, Walmart recently doubled its vaccine incentive for store workers to $150. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not the best start to the week as traders, too, take in all the latest COVID news. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's switch over to some retail news for a bit. The digital payments company Square made a deal to buy Afterpay, an Australian fintech firm, for $29 billion. Afterpay is one of several buy now, pay later services. You may have seen prompts for others, like Affirm, Bill Me Later, and Klarna, if you've been shopping online recently. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gives us a refresher on how these online installment companies work.
Buy now, pay later. Sounds familiar.
Well, technically, if you want to get into it, I mean, paying with a credit card is buying now and paying later.
That's Sheridan Trent at the Straw Hacker Group, a payments consulting firm. A few ways they're different. With buy now, pay later services, when you make a purchase on a retailer's website or through an app, you agree upfront to pay in a certain number of installments. There's pay in four.
Some of them will do like pay in three, some of them pay in six.
Another big difference compared to credit cards?
Many of these come without interest, as long as you pay it back in time.
And often, buy now, pay later companies do not run a credit check. Colleen McCreary is a financial advocate at Credit Karma, which has surveyed people who use these services.
For a number of people from our surveys, what we've seen is that for folks, it doesn't feel like debt.
Of course, it is debt. And Credit Karma also found that 38% of people who used buy now, pay later services had missed a payment.
And of that group, 72% said that they did see their credit score decrease slightly.
Customers who miss a payment also owe fees and sometimes interest, which is one way buy now, pay later companies make money. The other is by charging retailers. Marie-Claude Nadeau at McKinsey says retailers have to pay to allow their customers the option of using these services.
And they'll make that decision if they think those customers will spend more with them if they can spread their payment over 6 weeks.
Or 6 months, or whatever. Retailers see this as enough of a draw that they're often willing to pay higher fees than they do to accept credit cards. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
By the way, if you miss us on the radio, we also have a podcast. You can even binge listen if you like. Download Marketplace wherever you get your podcasts. Speaking of stuff online, Wikipedia has more than 1.5 million biographies of famous intellectuals and academics, but less than 19% of those bios are about women. So activists host edit-a-thons to boost the number of biographies of notable women, but many of those bios are targeted for deletion in ways that articles about men are not. Francesca Tripodi, an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, has done some research on this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You kick off your paper with one anecdote of Dr. Donna Strickland as an example of the differences in how these biographies are treated. What happened to her story on Wikipedia?
Donna Strickland is a physicist who invented a technology used by high-powered lasers in the world, and she was honored with the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2018. Now, this made headlines everywhere when she won the Nobel Prize but didn't have a Wikipedia page. And if you look at the revision history for Donna Strickland, you'll see that her biography was created in 2014, but that it was nominated for deletion and flagged for a speedy deletion and shortly erased right after this. And here is what we really get at when it comes to deletionism as a cultural practice on Wikipedia. There's definitely a reason to sometimes delete content, right? There can be vandalism or there could be complications within Wikipedia. But the default to erase notable women rather than simply fix their page is the broader problem that we're trying to look at here.
There was another example of this. You highlight the story of Lois K. Alexander Lane, which was flagged for you by a fashion design student.
For those people who might not know, Lois K. Alexander Lane is a woman who played just an incredible role in memorializing the historic contributions of African-American fashion designers. She founded two museums, the Harlem Institute of Fashion and the Black Fashion Museum. She wrote multiple books. She had boutiques. She designed her own clothes. And she also won awards for her prominent role she played in the Black community. And what I think is really discouraging about her case is you can tell by data matching that an article for Lane, someone tried to create this page during an edit-a-thon, and that when they tried to create this page, someone deemed that Lane was not yet historically notable, and they denied the page for inclusion on Wikipedia. And so this is a really interesting example, right, where you have someone who very clearly meets Wikipedia threshold for inclusion, and yet it still seems like it's not enough for women. And you have to wonder, well, when is it enough for someone to get themselves a Wikipedia page?
So why does that matter?
Well, basically, it matters for a few reasons. The data on Wikipedia also teaches AI systems and are used by Google, Alexa, and Siri. So when women go missing from Wikipedia, that absence reverberates. But also, it's extremely discouraging and frustrating. So there are a subset of editors that are really devoted to trying to close this gender gap. And so when they have to take extra time out of their day to keep these pages up, that's an additional labor toll and also an additional emotional toll on people who are already taking this time as volunteers to make Wikipedia a more equitable place.
How much of this is specific to Wikipedia and how much is a whole of internet problem?
You know, unfortunately, I think this is bigger than just Wikipedia. This is, I think, women having to manage and create safe spaces for themselves is something we see across platforms. It's also something we see in physical space as well. You know, there are gyms devoted just for women because many of us don't feel comfortable in co-ed spaces. There are many situations in which when women speak up or talk out of place, they are reprimanded for that participation. And so I think a lot of the trouble that we see in my data is definitely indicative of broader problems online and also a huge problem for women in the workplace more generally.
Francesca Tripodi is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. This has really been a lot of fun.
Coming up.
I've been there since I was about 13.
Perhaps a little young for the job, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 97.2% to finish at 34,838. The Nasdaq rose 8 points, almost flat, to end at 14,681. And the S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.1%, to land at 4,387. Since we were talking about that trillion-dollar infrastructure bill, let's look at some of the sectors that could touch. Freight Car America, stock ticker RAIL, rail, lost 1.5%. Construction Partners, Inc., they've got asphalt plants, fell 2.4%. AT&T climbed 0.2%. And we heard from Kristen about Walmart's proposed COVID-19 vaccine mandate for employees. Walmart dropped 0.2%. Big box competitor Costco shed 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Now, I might be a bit biased, but journalism can fill an important role in society as a place of record and holding those in power to account. That said, it's no secret that many local news outlets are struggling to survive, and it's only gotten harder in the pandemic. According to the Pew Research Center, estimated newspaper ad revenue last year was down 29% from before the pandemic, which is an 82% decrease from its peak in the year 2000. At the same time, there are fewer than 31,000 newsroom jobs left across the country, which is down 57% from 2004. So, is the news industry failing as a business? Nikki Usher is a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In her book, News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism, she writes that this business is in a state of market failure, with many communities slipping through the cracks in coverage.
There have just been places across the U.S. that have never really been seen to be viable news markets, and they're kind of the ones, for better or worse, that you might predict, right? So the African American South, right, that what we call the Black Belt or the Blue Belt, working class country or Appalachia, Native American reservations and Native American lands. That doesn't mean that those communities don't have news, but the kind of news that we tend to think of as being sort of the best authoritative providers of most professional news and information just hasn't existed in these places, really, or these places have been tremendously under-resourced.
The section of your book that really struck me, it's at the end of chapter two, where you say, perhaps what is most disappointing is that revenue models for journalism make these divides more severe. There is no commercial reason to more accurately and empathetically cover those who will never pay to read what is written about them.
Yeah, and I think that really is the point. If you're not going to get a huge subscriber base from the African American South areas in Mississippi and Alabama, why, if they're never going to read it, why bother, right? And I think that starts to distort our understanding of what democracy looks like. And now that we're in market failure, right, and you're trying to think about the best way to concentrate news resources, it's sort of these markets that don't generate anything for the bottom line become increasingly places and communities we talk about rather than with.
You focus, yes, on who news is for, people who can pay increasingly. But what about who makes the news? How has the way this business operates shaped who is actually in newsrooms across America?
Unfortunately, for the past 40 years, diversity numbers in the institutional news media have really barely budged. These are primarily white institutions, and it's getting harder and harder for people who are non-white or don't have elite credentials or don't have a financial safety net to get into these news organizations because it's simply a question of labor precarity.
You also point to a lack of geographic diversity in the people making decisions about what news gets covered and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you think about where you're talking to me from Washington, D.C., and where Marketplace headquarters is in L.A., you can think about the traditional media centers, and they've kind of always been media centers, but it's harder and harder for people without means to get to these cities and make a go of it. But also going to some of these elite schools kind of in places like Washington, D.C., let's think about George Washington University, where I used to teach. That is a school that many students would choose precisely because of that proximity to amazing internships. This geographic polarization that we see where there are these sort of big regional city winners on the coasts is really trickling down to sort of the entire labor pipeline for journalism.
So we are on Marketplace. It's a business and economics show. How do these problems that you lay out affect what news about the economy gets covered, what businesses get covered, and the way that economics is discussed in this country?
Well, I think that what we see is a nationalization around news and information. What you end up losing is that kind of understanding of what's happening in non-big cities, right? It doesn't make sense to go into West Virginia and continue talking to coal miners when there are really other interesting stories to be done, but not knowing on the ground what those stories are, you get tied into these old traditional stereotypical tropes that kind of reflect an image about a place rather than what's actually going on the ground.
What happens if we don't find a solution to this market failure in journalism?
We're going to end up with a really distorted understanding of our own democracy, because when only some people can afford to pay for news and only some people can afford to be journalists, you're not really getting the kind of play to that democratic ideal of what journalism can and ought to be. And we already see what's happening now. What happens when it gets worse?
Nikki Usher is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For many teenagers, summer break is that golden time to take a break from the daily grind of school and enjoy those long sunny days outside. But for some, the time off is an opportunity to make some cash. And in the thick of the pandemic, teenagers are picking up even more jobs than usual. The ratio of 16 to 19-year-olds who work reached nearly 32% in June, up from about 25% last year. So on today's installment of our series, My Economy, we hear from one teen about her summer job.
My name is Badra McClatchy. I'm 17. I'm a junior in high school, and I'm from Chicago. I will currently work at Chicago Lights Urban Farm. Right now, I'm currently a crew leader because I moved up. I've been there since I was about 13. What we do there is we grow vegetables. We harvest flowers. I just love doing it. I wanted to work when I was pretty young because I felt like it would go a long way, would help me to handle money, basically provide for my own self when I get older. The total stipend is like $850, but I don't really do the farm for the money. I just like going there, and like I want to go to culinary college because the farm like took us on a field trip to culinary college and we got to cook in there. So I was like, I want to be a chef really bad and not have to always depend on my mom for stuff. But right now is like almost time for me to get my driver's license, so I'm saving up for a car right now.
That was Badra McClatchy in Chicago, Illinois. This series only works with your help. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out. Over the weekend, the pandemic moratorium on evictions expired. Democrats in Congress wanted the White House to extend it, but the Supreme Court told the Biden administration that the CDC was stretching the limits of its authority with the eviction ban in the first place. Renters now have to pay their current and back rent unless the individual state or city where they live has its own moratorium. Congress did set aside more than $45 billion in COVID relief funds to help pay back rent in order to keep renters in their homes and help landlords pay their bills. But so far, only about $3 billion of that money has actually made it out the door. Here's your Monday moment of economic context. Just a few more numbers on that eviction moratorium expiring. The Census Bureau does a bunch of surveys on how stable people are when it comes to paying rent. And as of July 5th, an estimated 3.6 million people were worried about facing eviction in the next 2 months, aka about now. And 11 million folks are seriously delinquent on rent. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kimberly Adams, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.